for being here. Thanks for coming if you're just arriving from somewhere. Layman Pong was sitting in his thatched cottage one day with his family, studying the sutras. "Difficult, difficult, difficult," he suddenly exclaimed. "Like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seed in the top of a tree." "Easy, easy, easy," his wife, laywoman Pong, answered. "It's like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed." "Neither difficult nor easy," said their daughter, Ling Zhao. "It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips." You might not believe me, but I don't think I've ever mentioned Layman Pong in a Dharma talk. And I was already planning to before I knew Norman was going to do that. So that's kind of weird. Difficult, difficult, difficult. Or is it easy, easy, easy? Or neither difficult nor easy? What a beautiful image. The teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips. Have you ever on a sunny morning really looked at the dew on the grass tips? I think the diamond industry would collapse if we really looked carefully at dewdrops, don't you think? They're just as beautiful, maybe more. A few more thoughts about Layman Pong. The book called The Recording Sayings of Layman Pong was one of the first, was amongst the early English language literature on Zen. Published, I think, in 1971. And it was co-written by a really interesting person, Ruth Fuller Sasaki, a pioneering Western woman involved in Japanese Zen. And the book says the sayings of Layman Pong, but actually a lot of them are stories about the Pong family, the whole family. These are family stories. And each of the three members of this family may be showing us a different facet of our life, you know? We are all three of them, aren't we? Layman Pong, so difficult. Laywoman Pongs, nothing. It's easy. And then maybe somewhere, when we listen carefully, we're their daughter. Not caught in that duality, easy and difficult. And this story makes me think about the journey of our Shusou. Her preparation and her work during the practice period that she shared with us so beautifully through her talks and her Dharma of Anger class. And just by hanging around. And you know, being Shusou is definitely difficult, 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 right?
Easy, easy.
Previous version of Connie would have answered differently. It does sound difficult, though, to our mind that divides things, doesn't it, into difficult and easy, all the stuff you have to do. Show up with your peers in a whole new way, a new role. There's no hiding as the Shusou. You take the teacher's seat for the duration of the practice period, share the teacher's seat. You're asked to open your heart and open your mouth and teach in the community. And this can be intimidating. But also, true enough, it's easy, easy, easy. The word shuso actually means head seat, chief seat, like, you know, these kind of seats. So the actual job is done completely with your butt. Not your head. You have to sit there. Your job is to sit there, to hold that seat, to take that seat, to hold that space. You get to have tea with the wondrous members of the community and get to know them a little better. What a delight. You realize once you start teaching the classes that really your job is to listen more than to speak, and to include and honor and support the wisdom all around you. And Connie did that beautifully in her class, giving lots of room for us to talk to each other, inviting different Sangha members to share a few words in each class. There's nothing to it, you know? You just ride the waves and coordinate. Connie's been in close contact with me after each of those six or seven classes, which I've appreciated very much. And finally, this last Wednesday night, after the last of her classes, Connie said almost nothing, she opened and had each of us share a little bit of what we've learned about anger, and it was fascinating. Every one of us seems to have a different relationship to anger or a different sense of anger, you know, realizing anger is just a five-letter word or a concept for something deep in our gut, deep in our heart. And at the end, Connie just said a little bit. And afterwards, she shared with me that she had all this other stuff prepared that she wanted, was going to say, but realized, not needed. It's enough. And then she said to me, well, the class is done. Easy. Sense of ease. Nothing to worry about. And giving her first formal Dharma talk during Sesshin, which is kind of a thing, done. In a way, this question of easy and difficult is exactly the conversation Connie and I have been having for 15 or 16 years, something like that. One of us taking one position or the other. Things around here seem really difficult, they seem really easy. Me tending to often express the easy side. Don't worry about it, you know, no biggie. And we've gotten into some tangles at times about this. And maybe you've gotten into tangles with people in the same way. One of you taking one position, this is going to be really difficult. The other taking the other position. What are you so worried about? You know, come on, relax. Neither of which helps the other, right? At all. And maybe now both Connie and I can realize, and we can all realize together with each other, that either position is missing the mark. Either position is a kind of dividing and simplifying things in a way that's not going to help us or the world. Neither difficult nor easy, said Pang Ling Zhao. Teachings shining through everywhere. The 100 grass tips means everywhere, everywhere in the universe. Everywhere you can imagine, everywhere you can see or not see, is shining through. Just like the colors in cedar tree bark, just like the glistening eyes of a deer, just like the moist eyes of another human being, when we actually look and actually receive each other. That we don't have to figure out what's easy or difficult anymore. But we do, it seems like, have to really show up. Even if we don't know what to do or how to do it, we can make tons of plans or no plans. You know, it's unclear to me which is better at this point. And showing up is not so easy, but it's also not so difficult. It's showing up. I want to make a little aside to talk about Ruth Fuller Suzuki, because she lived an unbelievable life. And just to honor another pioneering Zen woman, as we honor Connie this weekend. I was going to read you a whole section of this book, but I think now I'll just share a little bit about her. So there's a recent book out about her called Zen Odyssey. It's not the best book ever written, but it's a wonderful offering nonetheless. These authors spent 5-6 years talking to her relations and digging into the history, talking to everybody, anybody who knew, remembered anything from any of the characters involved. Ruth Fuller Suzuki was born Ruth Fuller in 1892 in Chicago to a wealthy, educated family. So she had indeed some class advantages and race advantages, white woman. But a woman growing up at the turn of the century. And she was duly married off to a banker, many years her senior, who was in poor health, died, I think, when she was about 40. And somehow in her childhood, I don't remember how, and it says in great detail in the book, so we could look, she got interested in Eastern philosophy, just kind of on her own, you know, as a teenager or young 20s maybe, reading all about this stuff. And then she and her wealthy husband did some world tours, and in one of them she convinced him that they needed to go to Japan. He wasn't that interested. They went to Japan. And she somehow connected with the famous D.T. Suzuki, who's part of every story of Zen in the West somehow. I don't know how he got around that much yet. And she didn't want to just learn philosophy or study with D.T. Suzuki, who, you know, later, a little bit later, ended up at Columbia in New York. She really wanted to practice. And in 36 or 37, somehow she finagled to spend 3 months living in a house next to a temple, the house owned by the temple priest, doing zazen like full time. So there's a fabulous story in the book about this. Mostly just on her own, getting up, doing solo sesshin for a couple of months, and having a kind of a big awakening experience. And eventually going on to marry Sokeyon Suzuki, who was a Japanese Zen pioneer in New York. And he soon died after that. And she ended up in Japan in 1958, becoming the first foreigner to become ordained in the Rinzai Zen tradition. Not the first female foreigner, the first foreigner, period. And the only Westerner and the only woman to date to be given a priesthood, given like an abbacy of a temple in the Rinzai Zen tradition. She was given the abbacy of a sub-temple at Daitokuji, which our Tenza was just talking about. And she was part of why Gary Snyder ended up there. She used her resources to start a translation and study bureau and invited young scholars. Somehow, Gary Snyder and others that we've heard of ended up there. So I just wanted to give a little shout out to Ruth Fuller Suzuki. She was also apparently a very domineering person and kind of difficult to be around, you know, like most people who get stuff done, you know. Did I say something? There were some details about when she first got involved in the Buddhist Society of America, which became First Zen Institute of America, which was the organization that grew up around this Japanese priest in New York, in his apartment, you know, Sokeyon. And they managed to talk to relatives of survivors saying, oh yeah, she drove everybody crazy, you know. Bowled in there, wanted to be in charge of all the committees, and she also had all the money, you know, so, yeah, so anyway. It's not like any of us are perfect, but we make our contribution, right? And somehow, Ruth Fuller Suzuki, like so many other of these pioneers, we talked about G.U. Kennett a couple of years ago, same thing. Didn't believe whatever story of difficult she would have been taught deeply, right? About doing what she did. Helping to bring Zen to the West in that way. Which all brings us, I think, somehow to the question of activism, which both Connie and Norman brought up so powerfully. I really appreciated their talks. And I also appreciated being a bit challenged by their talks. Did you feel a little challenged by those talks? We should feel a little challenged, shouldn't we? If our whole thing here was just to celebrate what great buddies we are and how nice it is to be in this beautiful place, maybe that wouldn't be quite enough. And the problems in the world do seem difficult, don't they? So I was thinking about activism and quietism. And quietism kind of has a bad rap, you know? And activism is great. We all like activism. So I don't know if you are up to date on this, and I might be a little out of date, but did you know that the student activists at Marjorie Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, decided to throw up a GoFundMe to support their efforts? Do you know about this? I read this in like a major news outlet, so I think it's actually true. but the part, what I'm about to say, is being, you know, being teenagers who have a certain orientation towards what should happen, they put a $1 million goal on their GoFundMe campaign to support their activism. And you can imagine their parents, after in the wake of this tragedy, wanting to be supportive, but kind of like resisting the urge to say, no, don't put that. How about 10,000? They didn't. They put $1 million. The first million was raised by 1,400 individuals. The next half million was given by George Clooney. Then George Clooney calls up all his buddies, and they're at about $3.5 million now. So somehow the world is seeing such tremendous hope and possibility in these young people, you know, who just survived a horror like that, you know. And that's pretty wonderful and exciting. On Monday after the Valentine's Day shooting, some students at Seahome High School, and then I think they connected with a few friends at Bellingham High and Squalicum High, the three high schools of Bellingham, started communicating with each other on whichever Insto chat Facebook messenger they use. There's a million of them you've never heard of. Like, you know, email's way too old school, you know, for these guys. Anyway, they started talking about, well, maybe we should rally. Maybe we should gather. That was Monday after school. On Wednesday, 2,000 of them converged on City Hall and had a student-organized rally for which they successfully got permits from the police, permission of the city authorities, and negotiated the support of the school administration. Well, as a parent, I get the emails from the school principal, the school superintendent, saying, well, of course we would like our children to be in school, but we want you to know, dear parents, that we support the efforts of our students. He gives a little background about how they'd organized this and the things I just told you. And they also wisely said, and we don't want any student to feel pressured, and we want all each student to make a choice. And it's up to you as the parent or guardian to decide whether to excuse the absence, but we support this effort. Apparently some districts, other places, are suspending and punishing children for walking out in protest like that. So I went on last Wednesday noon speakers were eloquent, with a few little teenage, you know, things in there, you know. You're still 16, 17, 18. First one was a young woman talking about living with constant suicidal thoughts since she was 10 years old. Until finally, someone identified that there's a mental health issue here, started treatment with a really good psychologist, some medication, lots of therapy. And she said, yeah, it's still hard to be in my head sometimes, but I'm living a good life now. And I want you to know that if I had access to a gun when I was 13 or 14, I don't think I'd be here. And lots of other discussion about the political situation and the failings of their olders and not-so-betters. Very eloquent, very powerful. And I stood there just thinking, wow, you know, I'm bearing witness to a historic moment. These young people, maybe they'll save us. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll save us after all. There's some more young people out there. But then on the walk home, I also started to think, well, am I just abdicating my responsibility? Why was I just watching on the fringes, you know? Difficult, easy, neither. I got all fired up, though. I really wanted to send Walker and his buddies, you know, we have a little bit of money, so I wanted to send Walker and his buddies to D.C. if they wanted to be part of the next protest, but Walker was like, yeah, you know. But he did walk out with his friends. They participated in the rally. Then they got pizza. But it's so hopeful and so exciting. And then watching a little bit of the news about the kids in Florida going down to the Florida State Legislature and speaking their minds and receiving a complex mix of support and resistance and rejection from the adults they were talking to. And then I got this email from the Southern Poverty Law Center pointing out a huge blind spot that I had not even thought of. What color are all these children talking to these legislatures, raising all this money with George Clooney, getting all this media attention and accolades? I also heard a little bit on the radio, a little radio piece interviewing a few of the kids involved and just talking about how flooded they are with messages of support and letters and emails and all channels, you know, flooded. It's overwhelming to them. And of course, meanwhile, they're suffering from the stress of what they witnessed and the friends they lost. So here's what the Southern Poverty Law Center points out. This week began with the sixth anniversary of Trayvon Martin's death. And it will end with a march commemorating the 53rd anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day voting rights activists were beaten by lawmen in Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge. By any measure, it's a week steeped in not only the history of racial inequality in America, but also in our rich history of activism. And nowhere is it more evident than at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where students have riveted the country with their pleas for gun reform after the horrific Valentine's Day that left 17 students and teachers dead. The students have relentlessly told their story, organized marchers, and pressured politicians. Their work, quote, converting grief into power, as Niti Upadhyay detailed for the New York Times, is part of a powerful legacy of American youth activism. In 1960, for example, teenagers led the civil rights movement when they conducted sit-ins at a Woolworth's lunch counter. A year later, young people endured brutal beatings on the freedom rides aimed at desegregating bus stations. In the Deep South, and 2 years after that, children as young as six braved police dogs and fire hoses in the 1963 Children's Crusade to end racial segregation in Birmingham, Alabama. Many in these last 2 weeks have hailed students in Parkland, Florida as the descendants of these courageous civil rights activists. But they are not the only, or even the first, teens working in the 21st century to end gun violence. In the wake of Trayvon Martin's death at the hands of a security guard in 2012, young people mobilized under the name Black Lives Matter to demand reforms, very similar to those now articulated by the students in Parkland. These students did not receive the same support or recognition that the nation has given Parkland students in these last 2 weeks. The way, quote, the way people are responding to predominantly white communities is notable. Whose movement is more valuable to support? Asked Dante Berry, co-founder of the racial justice group Million Hoodies. Million Hoodies. Writing for Teen Vogue, Lincoln Anthony Blades was more direct. Black youth, you've been passionately advocating for gun control. Black youth who've been passionately advocating for gun control measures have been demonized, obfuscated, and overlooked. And black young people are disproportionately affected by gun violence. And for years, they've been organizing anti-violence rallies, meeting with presidential candidates, proposing policy ideas, and holding weeks-long sit-ins. And they too have taken on the NRA. Parkland students themselves have credited Black Lives Matter for serving as a model for how to demand gun reform. As one of them is quoted as saying, "Much of what I've done and wanted to do was inspired by Black Lives Matter," said one of the students. "We're protesting the exact same way and being called heroes just because the majority of us are white. America needs to do better in so many ways. The fact that we have not given Black Lives Matter the same support we have given the students in Parkland should give us pause." And they conclude their email saying, "In the wake of unimaginable tragedy, we should celebrate Parkland students' success in calling for such urgently needed reform. At the same time, we have to own up to the nation's blind spot when it comes to who gets empathy in America and ask the question of whether it's race that makes all the difference." So I was so struck by that. You know, the thing about blind spots is you don't see them until you see them, right? Seems so obvious, you know, picturing those white, articulate, well-dressed, you know, young men and women at the Florida legislature last week. So I was trying to think about how our practice, the quietism side of this is important and really matters. And I thought about this a lot since the last presidential election. The thing that keeps coming back to me as most important is probably the most difficult for us to talk about or share with anybody. But it's this teaching from Layman Pong and his family. The way the mind so easily divides things up into this or that, right? And the whole nation is just awash in us and them, this and that, black and white. Right and wrong, liberal, conservative, and so on and so forth. But we're not liberal or conservative, are we? Neither liberal nor conservative, liberal and conservative, just people. And somehow, who knows how exactly, intensive training in Zazen and the teachings that have been brought and given and offered to us with such generosity help us to develop a heart that can hold these opposites without needing to cling to one side or the other so fiercely. Somehow, it cultivates a kind of openness, a kindness that can still exist in the face of horror and strife and difficulty. Maybe the only way we can share that is by modeling it in our lives, I don't know. So the first thing I thought of is this kind of holding opposites. It's working with the dualities of the mind and little by little freeing ourselves from that narrowness of division. And we do this experientially in this kind of contrived situation, wearing our funny outfits, you know, where we decided some things are really important, like who gets to give the Dharma talk or who gets to be Shuso or which way you should turn when you stand up for Kinhin or how you should serve the food. On purpose, we make these unimportant things very, very important to study our crazy minds, you know? We get upset with each other. We get so delighted with each other. The whole drama of humanity unfolds within this one room, doesn't it, you know? And inside our own minds. It's a serious business. So this is a kind of a training for the world, isn't it? So I thought of holding opposites, and I also thought of being able to hold suffering without turning away from it, which we're practicing in just a hands-on, embodied way, right? Just by sitting still for half an hour at a time through the waves of the mind and the pain in the body, practicing a kind of non-reactivity and a kind of being with or holding or whatever language you use. Practicing not something that's beyond language. How can we just be with suffering in a way that's creative and open, non-reactive, and felt, and really felt, not turning away? And that made me think of a song. If you know this, feel free to join me. For some reason, I've had Cat Stevens on my mind a lot lately. You know, he reemerged in the public music scene. Did you know that? A couple of years ago, apparently. I didn't catch it when he first came back. He kind of went into hiding for decades, you know. So he's singing his original catalog, you know. Yeah, who knew, you know. This came out in 1971, same time as Ruth Fuller Suzuki's book in Layman Pong. So it all goes together. Trouble, oh trouble, set me free. I have seen your face and it's too much for me. Trouble, oh trouble, can't you see? You're eating my heart away and there's nothing much left of me. I've drunk your wine. You have made your world mine, so won't you be fair? So won't you be fair? I don't want no more of you, so won't you be kind to me? Just let me go where I'll have to go there. Trouble, oh trouble, move away. I have seen your face. And it's too much for me today. So our practice, I think, helps us to be with the trouble. And that's important, you know. How much of the suffering and strife in the world is sideways emanations of a heart destroyed by trouble, not able to hold the suffering of being a person. And as Norman mentioned, it's embarrassing to be, in a way, so privileged, you know, but still there's suffering. And maybe in whatever little way we can share a practice of being with, starting wherever we start. And then there's so many practical ways our practice helps that are easier to talk about with people and demonstrate and share. One is just slowing down, for goodness sakes, right? And we need this odd structure that we've inherited / created to just get us to stop. We need the group effect. If all of us would be embarrassed if we started, you know, we ran out of here and got on our phones, you know? So we stay through our busyness and our craziness. And that flows out into our lives. I just went on a little walk today and I was coming up towards the stoplight or stop sign and the pedestrian had the countdown thing. I was about half, like a quarter of the block away, and it was on 4 or 5, right? I could have gone for it. Which is this deep habit, right? This deep habit that we, that's so infectious. That we share, you know, we're good at sharing hurry. We hurry with each other. So maybe we can practice sharing non-hurry with each other. So actually slow down. And I could actually somehow, after a day and a half of sitting here, remember at least once that there's a pleasure in just standing here quietly at the corner, you know, and breathing and feeling the sun. What a beautiful day, you know. I was not in a hurry, you know. That made me think of another snippet from the early 70s. This is the early 70s study. Early 70s talk, I guess, yeah. I was alive then, but I was pretty young. In 1972, some psychologists from Princeton published a famous psychological study that's much cited even to this day. I'm always a little nervous about being a research, because what I know as an outsider, you know, which research is really good, but I've heard this cited by people that I know to be good researchers, so I'll assume it's good. So this is called the Good Samaritan Study. Have you heard of this study? I've quoted it before, but it's worth remembering, you know? It's worth remembering. It's one of these, I love these clever studies where they trick people. To find out how we actually act if we're not just responding to what we think someone else is supposed, wants us to do, you know? Like what we really do, when nobody's looking, kind of, you know. They took a bunch of seminarians at Princeton, you know, the study? And they told them, great news, we have an extra special super seminar for you on writing good sermons. It's optional, you can sign up for it. Little did the young seminarians know that they were signing up for a psychology study. And they gave them some standard kind of coaching on how to write a good sermon. And half of them were told, invited to write a sermon on the story of the Good Samaritan. Half of them were invited to write a sermon on job opportunities in the pastoral world or something like that. You know, practical talk for seminarians, you know. And the researchers were curious to see if reflecting on the story of the Good Samaritan, if reflecting on good moral values, if reflecting on ethics would affect behavior. That was one variable. The other variable was the variable of hurry. They divided things into sort of six quadrants. There was the Good Samaritan talk and the job talk. And then there were three hurry conditions. The high hurry kids, somebody sidles up to them as they're just barely finishing writing their talk and says, "We're really sorry, we kind of blew the timing, you're late. You got to deliver this talk, it's across campus, you really better go." And then the low hurry kids were told, "Oh, just, you know, when you finish up, it's, you know, you got some time, but you probably should get down there, you know." And then they had some message for the medium hurry condition. And somehow, I don't know how they do all this, but somehow they organized it so that they ended up walking alone down the campus pathways, you know. And then they had a Confederate there walking along. It suddenly falls down and moans in pain in front of the seminarian. And the data is, what does the seminarian do? Does he or she stop and help? Do they keep going, you know? Do they remember later and try to call somebody? You know, what do they do? Well, we'll start with the depressing news. Only 10% of the high-hurry seminarians stopped. I know. And there was a small effect from whether they were giving their talk about the story of the Good Samaritan, but it was not statistically significant. The other end of the spectrum, still a little disappointing, but the other end of the spectrum, 63% of the low-hurry seminarians stopped. And I, the data summary I saw didn't say how many of them later said, you know, I think I saw some back there, you know. I had to get to my talk, but, you know. So, I don't know, you know. But it is true, isn't it, in our experience? When we're stressed out, right, when we're in a rush, we have too much to do, we're not so available, really, are we? Not too available to the world. We're not too available to help. So this is like so simple, but yeah, you know. We're training deeply in a non-hurry condition here, you know. You know, may we all keep nurturing that and not let it just fade away a few days from now. Can we devote ourselves to presence, you know, to openness? So those are the four things I thought of. There's a lot more. It's not a definitive list. The ways that quietism might support activism. Actually, no, there's one more. I only mentioned three. So we'll do one more. I'll close with one more. So I thought of holding opposites, being able to not divide things up so much, hold opposites, be able to hold suffering, devoting ourselves for slowing down, to slowing down. And the last one is to increase our curiosity about perception. To recognize through our time in the cushion, our interactions with each other, our interactions with our teachers, that the world, thank you very much. You're a good mind reader.
Good That's training.
A, yeah. That the world we think is out there is actually a world that we are perceiving and manufacturing, right? We're taking in little bits of data, you know, through our senses and thoughts bubbling up, and we're constructing a world. It's not always exactly the same world that everyone else is in, you know, maybe never, you know. So I got a cute little story on perception to close my talk, which was a part of, this is also a Kanye reference. This is this little story. I read it before in a Dharma talk on perception. That was Connie's favorite talk. She said it was my funniest ever talk. So, so here's the a little story called Museum. It's a prose piece written by a poet, so it's very efficient prose. So the writing geeks in the audience can appreciate that as it unfolds. This is like three pages maybe.
This is great.
Of a complete little story here. So just to plant that seed of curiosity about is what we're perceiving really the world, you know? We're so upset about the world sometimes, but is it really the world? So this is Naomi Shihab Nye, Palestinian-American poet, wonderful person, speaking. I was 17. My family had just moved to San Antonio. A local magazine featured an alluring article about a museum called the McNay, an old mansion once the home of an eccentric, many times married watercolorist named Marion Kugler McNay. She had deeded it to the community to become a museum upon her death. I asked my friend Sally, who drove a cute little convertible and had just moved to Texas a year before we did, if she wanted to go there. Sally said sure. She was a good friend that way. We had made up a few words in our own language, and we could dissolve into laughter just by saying our words. Our mothers thought we were a bit odd. And so, on a bright, sunny Saturday afternoon, we drove over to Broadway. Sally asked, "Do you have the address of this place?" "No," I said, "but just drive slowly. I'll recognize it. There was a picture in the magazine." I peered in both directions and pointed, saying, "There it is. Pull in." The parking lot under some palm trees was pretty empty. We entered, excited. The museum was free. Right away, the spirit of the arched doorways, carved window frames, and elegant artwork, overtook us. Sally went left, I went right. A group of people seated in some chairs in the lobby stopped talking and stared at us. "May I help you?" a man said. "No," I said, "we're fine." I don't like to talk to people in museums. Tours and docents get on my nerves. What if they talked a long time about painting that you weren't interested in? I took a deep breath and moved on to another painting. Fireworks over a patio in Mexico, maybe? There weren't very good tags in this museum. In fact, there weren't any. I stood back and gazed. Sally had gone upstairs. The people in the lobby had stopped chatting. They seemed very nosy, keeping their eyes on me with irritating curiosity. What was their problem? I turned down a hallway, Bougainvillea and azalea pressed up right against the windows. Maybe we should have brought a picnic. Was that a Moorish courtyard? I saw some nice sculptures in another room and a small couch. This would be a great place for reading. Above the couch hung a radiant print by Paul Klee, my favorite artist. Blues and pinks merging softly in his own wonderful way. I stepped closer. Suddenly I became aware of a man from the lobby standing behind me in the doorway. Where do you think you are? He asked. I turned sharply. The McNay Art Museum. He smiled then and shook his head. Sorry to tell you, the McNay is 3 blocks over on New Brunfels Street. Take a right when you go out of our driveway, then another right. What is this place? I asked, still confused. He said, well, we thought it was our home. My heart jolted. I raced past him to the bottom of the staircase and called out, Sally, come down immediately. Urgent. I remember being tempted to shout something in our private language, but we didn't have a word for this. Sally came to the top of the stairs, smiling happily, and said, you have to come up here. There's really good stuff. And there's old beds. No, Sally, no, I said, as if she were a dog or a baby. Get down here. Speed it up. Emergency. Sally stepped elegantly down the stairs as if in a museum trance, looking puzzled. I just couldn't tell her out loud in front of these people what we had done. I actually pushed her towards the front door, waving my hands at the family in the chairs, saying, sorry, oh my God, please forgive us. You have a really nice place. Bye. That's like one word. Sally stared at me in the parking lot. When I told her, she covered her mouth and doubled over with laughter, shaking. We were still in their yard. I imagined them inside looking out the windows at us. She couldn't believe how long they'd let us look around without saying anything. That was really friendly of them, she said. Get in the car, I said. The real McNay was fabulous. Splendid. But we felt a little nervous the whole time. Van Gogh, Picasso, Tamayo. This time there were tags. This time we stayed together in case something else happened. And we never told anyone. 30 years later, a nice-looking woman approached me in a public place. Excuse me, she said. I need to ask you a strange question. Did you ever, by any chance, enter a residence long ago thinking it was the McNay Museum? 30 years later, my cheeks still burned. Yes, I said. But how do you know? I never told anyone. That was my home, she said. I was a teenager, sitting with my family, talking in the living room. Before you came over, I never realized what a beautiful place I lived in. I never felt lucky before. You thought it was a museum. My feelings changed about my parents after that, too. They had a really good case. They had good taste. They were really good to me. I realized that in that day, and I've always wanted to thank you. Yeah. So not always, but halfway sometimes our perceptual mess-ups are beneficial to people, too. So. We'll get to say lots of gratitude things tomorrow, but, it's time to stop. But I just want to say thank you to everybody. Connie and Norman and everybody in the Sangha. Everybody has been here a long time or a little time. And just to express this hope that what we're doing is not just about having a quietism club, you know? Something bigger. And it's difficult and it's easy and it's neither. Maybe some of us will continue the excellent work we're already doing out in the world. Maybe some of us will be inspired to do more. Maybe some of us will just focus on keeping places like this, taking care of places of peace and renewal, you know, whatever this is called. Because it all, I think, matters in ways that probably we can't totally understand. Maybe sometime 30 years from now, somebody will say, "Did you ever live in Bellingham?" Or wherever you live. So let's just do our best to do whatever that is for each of us. Thank you.
Amen. Yeah.